From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Elia Kazan, one of Hollywood's most influential and controversial directors, died yesterday at his New York home. He was 94. Kazan's ability to extract emotion from actors changed the course of 20th century film and theater in movies like On the Waterfront and East of Eden and stage and screen versions of A Streetcar Named Desire. But Kazan is also remembered for his role in a divisive period of Hollywood history. He named names in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee, putting 8 friends on the Hollywood blacklist. The act cost him dearly. Nearly 50 years later, Kazan is remembered by many with bitterness, by others with admiration. Tonight, On Point, the revered and reviled Elia Kazan. How do you remember Elia Kazan's films? What is his contribution to American cinema? Did naming names ruin his art for you or make him an anti-Stalinist hero? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Jeff Young, Dean of the Los Angeles Film School and author of The Master Director Discusses His Films, Interviews with Elia Kazan. Jeff Young, thanks so much for joining us.
You're more than welcome. I'm not sure you're going to still want to thank me after you finish. I must say I take great exception to the way in which you introduced the subject before your break and even the description that you just made, Mr. Beatty.
Well, good. Well, let's get right into that. But I also want to welcome Garen Daly. He's our On Point movie maven and artistic director of the Dedham Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts. Hello, Garen.
Hi, Jack. Hi, Jeff.
Jeff Young, take exception to us.
Here we go, man. Yeah. You introduced this subject by saying he was a man who betrayed his friends. I'm quoting you now. As much for his career as for his principles. Well, I mean, based on what do you arrive at that conclusion? I mean, that is stating your opinion as if it were fact, and I'm afraid that kind of reporting is exactly the problems that the media have landed us in and continue to carry us in right now. I mean, you sound like you were the sort of PR man for the White House at the moment. That's really inappropriate. I mean, well, you should preface that by saying, in my opinion, that is not a fact. And you also, you've just said, was he a anti-Stalinist
hero?
Now,
listen.
Or what? You know,
listen,
that's not correct.
You've had your moment.
Okay,
let's stop lecturing me and let's talk about this director. Give us the pre-history of this man. Take him up to his New York days. Where did he come from, and how did he rise?
He was born in Istanbul, before he was 4 years old, his family first moved to Berlin, where his father set up a plant on behalf of him and his uncle, then back to Istanbul, and when he was 4, he wound up in Manhattan, and by the time he was 9, he was in New Rochelle, and he was always a small kid and always thought of himself as rather funny-looking, and he managed, however, to do very well in school. His father was a very hard-working man who really believed that the whole point in life was to make money, and Aaliyah and his mother kept from him the idea that Aaliyah wanted to go to college and get a real education. And they saved up their money and literally in nickels and dimes and allowances and things like that. And he was able to go to Williams on a partial scholarship. His father was really angry because the tradition, and father was a very traditional man from Anatolia, was that the oldest son would go into family business. So going off and leading an independent life was a total betrayal. And at Williams, he found himself the outsider and the poor kid to the real sort of WASP establishment in the United States. And you have to remember, this was back at the end of the 20s when that establishment was right across the board in charge of things. And that's where he functioned out of a kind of rage and anger at the establishment his entire life, even when he became the most powerful man in American theater and films. And indeed, in many ways, arguably in charge of the establishment, he was still utterly anti-establishment.
How did he get into the theater? I mean, what was in his background that led to that?
Well, it was purely accidental, to tell you the truth, as he told the story both in his own autobiography and as he told it to me. When he finished at Williams, having had a liberal arts education, he was, as most liberal arts students who graduate, prepared to absolutely do nothing for a living. And he didn't know what to do with himself, and he had a friend who was going to Yale Drama School who told him that he could provide the most of the money for himself by continuing as a dishwasher and waiting on tables at Yale Drama School, just as he had paid his way through Williams that way. And he had, as he said, he had a vague notion that there was something in the arts that might be right mm-hmm. for him. And as much because he could get a job washing dishes and waiting as anything else, he picked Yale. And he thought that if he could have those 3 years as a kind of way to hide out and try to figure out what his real direction would be and what his real goals were, that would give him the time he needed. And that's the real truth.
I'll be darned. And then he went to New York, and he started out as an actor and then became a director.
Well, what happened was that when he was at Yale, he met a woman, first of all, named Molly Day Thatcher, who was to become his wife and the mother of their four children. And Molly Thatcher could not have been more of a WASP aristocrat. Her grandfather had been president of the Yale University, and she was very deep into the theater and extremely left-wing. Now we're talking about the height of the Depression, mm-hmm. and most, as you can imagine, students, kids, were really out there on the side of the working people, and very anti-establishment. And there was a theater going on in New York called the Group Theater that was a very advanced sort of avant-garde theater. And his friend Alan was going to their summer camp. They had just started recently. And in the summer, they were going off to practice and work out what they were going to do the following season. And Kazan went along. They had studied drama, which included acting and directing and all those things at Yale. And what he was mm-hmm. most comfortable with while he was at Yale, and what he thought he was going to wind up doing, was being a working backstage,
right.
Making scenery and props and things. He was a perfect handyman.
But he got on the boards.
Yes, he did.
And then he got behind the boards
and
found his métier really there, didn't he?
That is correct.
And what was his first big performance as a director?
First he was a star as an actor.
He was a star.
Yes, he became mm-hmm. a star in Waiting for Lefty, which was mm-hmm. One of the most famous plays
sure.
of its time, written by Odets. And Harold Clurman, who was one of the three founders of the group, was his mentor, and he directed a couple of plays for the group. One was Casey Jones, and it didn't work out. He did another one called Thunder Rock. It didn't work out. He had, you know, the kind of failures that all young men seem mm-hmm. to have as they're mm-hmm. starting out. His first hit was something called Café Crown, which was sort of the offshoot of the Yiddish theater. And that was the first kind of sort of success he had in the theater in mm-hmm. New York. And that led to, now we're in the 40s, and he was offered Skin of Our Teeth, Thornton Wilder's play.
Mm-hmm.
And that was for a number of quirky circumstances. The story goes that Orson Welles had dropped out or turned it down at the last minute. And then there were an awful lot of guys who were had signed up for the service already, and he got a chance.
So that was
and
his opening.
That was his. That's what launched him.
And after that, of course, a string of collaborations with Arthur Miller and others. Garen Daly, although he was making really theater history with some of these productions, he also wanted to make movies.
Yeah, in his documentary video, A Director's Journey, he talks about that he always wanted to make movies, that he was engaged in it. He actually took a couple screen tests in the 30s and was in a couple smaller films. And, you know, when you look at his body of work, when you look at his filmography, you have to look at his choices of topic. It's always important when you're looking at Kazan as a director, what his topics were. And it's interesting to note that one of his last films was The Last Tycoon, based on the Fitzgerald story about Monroe Starr, who's really Irving Thalberg, and all about the process of making movies. Now, the movie is not a great movie, and it fails in many, many ways, and it didn't really resuscitate his career. But there is a scene that I absolutely adore, this because it talks to me about how Kazan knew the language of cinema. He knew how to make – he knew the difference between literature and cinema. And in the scene that we're going to hear – Robert De Niro playing Monroe Starr, a.k.a. Irving Thalberg, is talking to a writer, a very popular writer of novels, played by Donald Pleasence. And in it, he's going to try and convince the literary guy what the difference between literature is and cinema.
Listen, a girl comes in. She doesn't see you. She takes off her gloves. She opens a purse. She dumps it out on the table. You watch her. Now, she has two dimes, a matchbox, and a nickel. She leaves the nickel on the table. She puts the two dimes back into her purse. She takes the gloves. They're black. Puts them into the stove. Lights a match. Feels by the stove. Suddenly, you notice there's another man in the room, watching every move the girl makes.
What happens?
I don't know. I was just making pictures.
What was the nickel for?
Jane, what was the nickel for?
The nickel was for the movies.
What do you pay me for? I don't understand the damn stuff.
Yes, you do. Or you wouldn't have asked about the nickel.
That's a scene from The Last Tycoon, the last film made by Elia Kazan, and that was Robert De Niro speaking. He played Irving Thalberg, a boy genius Hollywood producer, really.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that, you know, again, when I was talking about his choices before, why would Kazan take a movie about the end of an era of 30s movies with Irving Thalberg and make that as one of his last films too? I think he was kind of making a statement there that there was a parallel between what he did in Hollywood and what Irving Thalberg did in Hollywood.
How does that sit with you, Jeff Young?
Well, I think that's a very nice theory, but in fact, Kazan did The Last Tycoon because his mother had turned extremely ill and she couldn't stand any more New York winters. And it gave him an opportunity to have his mother directly living in his home while he was working and able to provide for and look after all of her medical needs by being in Southern California. That's not to say that the choice of doing the Fitzgerald thing wasn't unconsciously connected to his own career, but the conscious choice was based on circumstances that were external to the significance of the movie. And it had at first originally actually been offered to Mike Nichols by Sam Spiegel, who had been the man who, after many failures by Kazan and Schulberg to raise the money on the waterfront, had bailed them out and gotten the money for them so that he was able to make the film that was arguably his best movie and one most important to his career.
And strikingly, even from his first films, a command of the visual language, rare for a stage director moving right into films, isn't it?
Well, yes, and he actually made a conscious choice about that. For his first five movies, Tree Grows in Brooklyn, The Sea of Grass with Hepburn and Tracy, Boomerang, Pinky, and A Gentleman's Agreement. Mm-hmm. These were all very, very conventional studio films in which, as he said to himself, he was really kind of photographing plays, and he didn't know much about the movements. And the other fellow's correct. He always wanted to be a filmmaker. He really went into the theater in the first place because he had no other idea how to get into film. And after those first five, in which he actually had won an Oscar and he was really acclaimed, he was the hottest thing on Broadway, he walked away from the meaning. He'd done the first film that had a racial theme and also the first film about anti-Semitism, and he was thought to be a very deep thinker and a man utterly consumed by social issues.
Jeff Young, hold that thought. We'll be right back to you. We're talking about the great film director, Elia Kazan. What do you remember from his films? Join us at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the director of On the Waterfront, Elia Kazan. How do you remember his films? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Jeff Young, dean of the Los Angeles Film School and author of The Master Director Discusses His Films, Interviews with Elia Kazan, and Garen Daly, On Point movie maven and artistic director of the Dedham Theater. Garen, you've got now for us a slice from A Face in the Crowd, a movie I remember seeing as a boy in 1957. Set it up for us.
All right, here's the story. Andy Griffith, in one of his earlier roles, plays Lonesome Rhodes, this kind of hick rube guitar-playing guy who is picked up by Patricia Neal and made into a big hit on TV. Now, what makes this film really, really good is how prescient it is, talking about how powerful TV is and how it brings everything down to the lowest common denominator and how power and popularity is corrupt. And the scene that we're seeing now, Lonesome Rhodes, which is now a big, huge TV success, and Hollywood is now getting introduced to Washington because a senator wants to get elected.
Senator, I'm a professional, sir. And I have to look at the image on that screen same as I'd look at a performer on my show. And I'll have to say, he'll never get over to my audience. Not to the 65 million people who welcome me into their living rooms each week. And if I wouldn't buy him, do you realize what that means? If I wouldn't buy him, the people of this country aren't ready to buy him for that big job on Pennsylvania Avenue. Look, I got a fella here. You know where I found him? I don't think he'll mind my saying it. In jail. He's stupid. He's got no mentality. He thinks with his feet. But I trust those feet. Now, if he don't laugh, if he don't think the show is any good, then I know there's something wrong with it. Something people just ain't a-gonna take to. You see what I mean? Now, Beanie, what did you think of the personality you just saw on the screen? Come on. Give it to us straight.
Flatter than last night's beer.
You see your problem now, Senator?
That is a dialogue. I don't know who the second voice is, but it's Andy Griffith in one of his first film roles playing Lonesome Rhodes, a kind of demagogue of the radio, really speaking, you know, the talk show host, you might say. And the Jeff Young, wasn't there a controversy about this involving Arthur Godfrey, or am I just making this up?
No, you're not making it up. There were a lot of people at the time who thought that Arthur Godfrey had been the role model for the Lonesome Rhodes character. And that's partially true, but not entirely. Garen was right. This was a very, very prescient film. It was the first time. This was back in the mid-50s where Bud Schoberg had written a story called My Arkansas Traveler. And he and Kazan, having had so much fun and success and On the Waterfront, decided to do another one. And they saw in that film, with Eisenhower as the president, that people, the American public, were voting for an image and not the substance. And they realized the incredible power of selling and how there was an absolute natural marriage between show business or advertising and politics. And this had been even more supported by Kazan's experience with HUAC and Senator McCarthy, where McCarthy, on the other side of it, had been completely undressed, finally, by one shot on television where he was seen by the entire American public whispering behind his hand to Roy Cohn. And that's when Joseph Welch said, "Have you not one shred of human decency?" So they became aware of this as a potential problem and thought that if there was fascism ever in America, it would be grassroots, and that television was the most powerful propaganda tool, and that in Lord Acton's dicta, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Yes,
and that's it. That's what the movie's about.
And they saw it, as you say, early on. I mean, in the 1952 campaign, which was the first time television was used in any real way. The candidate Eisenhower was brought to a New York studio and had to do recordings for the television. And at one point, he said, "To think that an old soldier has come to this." It was like, "What am I doing?" But of course, now it's the proscenium. They have to do television, and that's the gate. Let's talk about his ability. That phrase, an actor's director. Jeff Young, what was his secret? How did he get the performances he got out of actors like Brando and Julie Harris, James Dean, on and on?
Well, first of all, he had been an actor himself, and he'd been trained as an actor in the group theater. And you start with the notion, you have to understand that those people that you just named, first of all, they had to have that talent inside them, for starters. And that's not a facetious remark. Really, one of the things that cut Kazan above the crowd was his ability to recognize that. And when he was studying at the group theater under Strasberg and Harold Klerman, and Klerman was his most important mentor, he was introduced to the theories of Konstantin Stanislavski, which were things that he wrote only about his own experiences in directing and working and acting in the Moscow Art Theater. And what the secret to it was that the actors were made to actually experience the emotions that the character is going through in the story, as opposed to imitating the mm-hmm. emotions. Mm-hmm. And when the thing is being done really and truly from the actor's soul in front of you, that has an enormous impact, far greater impact than the best imitator in the world.
Yes.
If you think...
And of course, the old tradition is the tradition of what they call the comedian, the man who puts on the mask. And it was well sort of set off in the movie Marathon Man, where the classic Laurence Olivier was working with Dustin Hoffman, and Dustin Hoffman kept running around the block to get out of breath. And Olivier said, "What are you doing, young man?" And he says, "I'm trying to feel out of breath." And he said, "Well, just act it." Take us to his next film here, your next film here, Garen, Gentleman's Agreement, what we used to call a problem picture.
Well, you know, one of the things about Gentleman's Agreement is that you take a look at it now. It was made in 1947, and it won a Best Director Oscar for Kazan. But, it's dated now. You see it and you look at it and you go, boy, that really doesn't work. But at the time, the topic of Jewish bigotry in the United States...
Anti-Jewish bigotry
in the United States was something that was closeted. No one talked about it. In fact, when Kazan was talking about doing this, Mayer and the other producers said, "Why? Don't rock the boat. This will be self-serving propaganda." The issue, though, is that what I find here is this is Kazan at his best, where he's talking about a problem that he feels very, very intensely about, and he brings it to the screen. And the scene we're going to be talking with, or we're going to be hearing from Gregory Peck and John Garfield, who had his own event with the House of Un-American Activities, but they're talking. It's a very brief clip, but it really shows Kazan at his best.
"You're wasting your time."
"Sure, but there must be a time once when you fight back, Dave. I want to make them look me in the eye and do it. I want the satisfaction. I can't explain it, but I want to do it for myself."
"Phil, nothing more
than..." "Let him do it, Kathy. You have to face him once. I did it once at Monterey."
"They are more than nasty little snobs, Kathy. You call them that and you can dismiss them. It's too easy. They're persistent little traitors to everything that this country stands for and stands on, and you have to fight them. Not just for the poor, poor Jews, as Dave says, but for everything this country stands for. Anyway, I'm going."
That is Gregory Peck talking to John Garfield in Gentleman's Agreement, which won Elia Kazan his first Oscar as Best Director. And Peck plays an undercover journalist, a journalist who's going to go undercover under the name Mr. Green, an ambiguous name, and expose anti-Semitism in polite society, really, at resorts and things like that.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things I think that kind of engendered this film is that this is post-World War II. And I think that there was a feeling of optimism that what were we fighting the fascists for? And one of these things was to make things good for the common man. And again, if you look at Kazan's work, there is this theme of him taking the side of the common man to try and uplift them and elevate them to a newer stature or to bring them on par with the rest of the world.
He identified with the outsider, Jeff Young.
That's That's correct. And he had a very, very strong and maintained all through his life and a very strong sense of social justice. He never, ever lost that right up to the very end. Very important to him.
We're joined now on the line by Victor Navasky. Victor, hello and welcome.
Hi.
Victor is, the former editor of The Nation and the author of Naming Names. Victor, give us the communism and anti-communism story of Elia Kazan.
Well, you want the 2-hour version?
No, I'll take the I'll take the short form.
Yeah.
I'll take the 2-hour version later.
Yeah, Kazan, as Jeff Young suggested in the beginning, and as you did in your question, he had belonged to the Communist Party in the 30s as a member of the group theater unit. He felt abused by the group theater unit. The party unit wanted him to vote in a particular matter to take over the group in a way that he considered dishonest. He left the party very disillusioned with it. And then as revelations came out about what was happening in the gulag and all of that, he turned into a sort of liberal anti-communist. And when the committee came along in what is wrongly known as the McCarthy period, because it started before McCarthy and it lasted after McCarthy faded from the scene, he, after first refusing to cooperate with it, ended up going along. And under the informal rules of the day, you were asked the question which came to mark the decade, are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? And if you answered as to yourself, and yes, mm-hmm. you had been, the next question was, who else was a member with you? And you couldn't refuse to answer that, and not because you were deemed to have waived your right to refuse under the Fifth Amendment if you did answer that. And he then, unlike any other witness who had chosen to cooperate with the committee and name names, took ads in the New York Times and Variety urging others in his situation to do likewise, and on the grounds that the battle between totalitarian communism and free democracy was required total openness, and that totalitarianism asked for secrecy, and he wasn't going to be part of it anymore. And he became the polarizing figure of the era, both because people who didn't want to cooperate with the committee felt that if he couldn't stand up to them, he was the most powerful director on Broadway at the time. He had directed the plays of mm-hmm. Tennessee Williams and Arthur Miller, and he was this fantastic Hollywood director. Who could? And so people believed that he did it for money or whatever, and that's the background as I understand it.
He gave the names of 8 people. What happened to them? What was the consequence for
them? Well, it's not the names that he gave. He gave the names of more than 8 people. Oh. Some of them were party functionaries as well, but the names that he gave, the committee already had. Truth is, they had the names of everybody whenever anyone testified, and it was a sort of a public ritual, a ceremony. But every time you got named, even if you had been named before, you suffered a kind of public obloquy. People had their children pulled out of schools because their names were in the headlines, and you were reinforcing the committee's right to ask the questions by going along with them. So.
Right.
But people who were named couldn't work in Hollywood anymore.
Right.
They lost their jobs. They were blacklisted.
Right. Well, of course, he made in 1954, Garen, 2 years later, he made a great movie that involves naming names.
Yes, and it's on the waterfront. And again, he won Best Director. It was Best Picture, 8 Oscars in total. So it was very well received. In this film, Marlon Brando plays a fighter who is now working on the docks. And there's corruption within the unions, and it takes courage on his part, Brando's part, to go forth to a criminal investigation into this union activity, much against his brother and everyone else except for a couple of people like Carl Malden and Eva Marie Saint. But he gets up there. He's getting sworn in.
Raise your right hand. Name, please.
Terry Malloy.
Swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Right.
I do.
I do.
Be seated, please.
Mr. Malloy, is it true that the night that Joey Doyle was found dead, that you were the last one to see him before he was pushed from the roof?
Yes, that's right.
And is it true that you went immediately...
Wait, except for the guys that pushed them off.
And is it true that you went immediately to the Friendly Bar and there expressed your feelings about the murder to Mr. Johnny Friendly?
John Friendly, right.
And now, Mr. Malloy, can you tell me whether Mr. Friendly, or I should say Mr. Scully, said anything to you to indicate his responsibility in getting rid of Joey Doyle?
Right.
And would you say, Mr. Malloy, that Mr. Friendly made it very clear to you that it was absolutely necessary that he murder Joey Doyle in order to maintain his control
of
the waterfront locals? Is that correct?
That voice you hear there saying turning it off was a bigwig who you only see the back of his head as he's watching the TV, watching this going on, and knowing what the answer is. You don't hear the answer in the movie. Again, Kazan being very good as a film director, keeping us on our edge. But yes, that's Terry Malloy naming names against the union.
Victor Novasky, did he achieve a kind of vindication with this film?
Well, you have to distinguish, it seems to me, how people felt at the time and how they felt, 40 years later.
Sure.
At the time, he didn't need to be vindicated. He was the top director of his day, and he made a great movie. And the people on the left who didn't like what he did before the committee didn't think any better of him for it. In fact, they resented him for his success. Yeah. And the interesting thing to me about the film was that at the time it was seen as about corruption on the waterfront, and later it came to be seen as this great allegory about the Un-American Activities Committee. And it's not just the storyline, but it's that Kazan had named names before the committee, Schulberg, who wrote the script, had named names before the committee, and in the clip we just heard, Lee J. Cobb, who played Johnny Friendly, had named names before the committee. And Cobb, when I interviewed him, said an interesting thing to me. I asked him the question you asked your guests about whether this was principled anti-communism or whether this was opportunistic. And Cobb, who is a very bitter man when I talked to him, said to me, when you asked me also who he named, etc., he said to me, well, how could you name, he named, among others, the stagehand of the group theater, a guy named Tony Kraber, who became a folk singer, never really made it big time. And Cobb said to me, how could you name Tony Kraber, a selfless man, a Band-Aid if you scratch yourself? So that must have been principled. If he reached that far, he said, it didn't sit well with me. And then Cobb said about himself, I didn't act out of principle. I wallowed in unprincipledness. I did it because I was starving. I was on my back. I had run out of money. I had gambled my fortune away. My wife had left me and gone into an institution. So you had this very bitter interpersonal thing going on. And that was the context in which this whole thing played out at the time.
Victor Novasky, hold that thought just a minute, please. We're talking about Elia Kazan, who died yesterday at 94. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Elia Kazan, one of the most influential of our movie directors. Kazan stirred controversy when it was announced that he would be given a Lifetime Achievement Oscar in 1999. Here is comedian Chris Rock at the award ceremony before Kazan's award was presented.
I'm loving it. It's a big controversial night. The Kazan thing, I saw De Niro backstage. You better get Kazan away from De Niro because he hates rats. Ha ha! Now.
Kazan later accepted the award. It was presented by Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro. Scorsese talked about Kazan's contribution to films.
The passion of his performers matched his passion to explore the suppressed but raging discontents of our civilization. At a time when the prevailing American voice was bland and glib, this poetic realist, this angry romantic, always spoke fervently to almost basic conflicts between races and religions, classes and generations, men and women.
Bittersweetly, Kazan accepted his award.
I want to thank the Academy for its courage, generosity, and I want to tell you that I've been a member of the Academy on and off for I don't know how many years. So I'm pleased to say what's best about them. They're damn good to work with. I also want to thank Marty. Where are you? Hide behind me. Come on here.
Right behind you.
Where's Marty?
Right here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Bobby De Niro. Okay, thank you all very much. I think I can just slip away.
That's Elia Kazan accepting a Lifetime Achievement Oscar in 1999. Let's take a call from Brian in Milwaukee. Hello.
Hi.
What's your question, please?
My question is this. We're talking about a man's great work, and I do not discount anything that your presenters have. But the fact that he focused on social ideas to represent the repressed, those that are under attack, mm-hmm. and the fact that he contributed to a very significant attack on a numerous group of people and ruined their lives. I mean, look at Lucille Ball. She was accused of being communist, and he didn't necessarily accuse her of it, but he helped to fuel the fire, and she could have lost a career. And it took a very large group of people to help fight that and to help try and get people to get over it. And now we're back to the same discussion of Muslims and comparing them to being communists and having this whole generational discussion all over again. And what I don't understand is how can you separate his work from what he's done historically?
Okay.
The fact that he represents social ideas. Mm-hmm.
Let's hear from Jeff Young on that, Jeff.
Okay, listen, you've thrown the ball right into my park. The first day I met Kazan, I explained to him that despite the fact that I'd come to him and was dying to have him teach me how to direct actors and how to direct period, that he had to know that my uncle was a blacklisted writer. So this was not an abstract philosophical question in my household, and I was directly 180 degrees against the position he had taken, and that he had to know that before we got into this. And he said, just ask me anything you want. You're entitled to your opinion. And I think personally that it's a very, very good thing that these questions get recycled. I'm delighted that there was so much controversy in 1999, because these are very fundamental questions about the world we live in and the Constitution of the United States and about our values as they get recycled. And if we ever arrive at a point in which we have the answers as to what is right and what is wrong, then we're in a lot of trouble as a nation. And I think it's very good that this fellow can call up and express his passionate belief that you can't separate someone's actual life from his artistic version, and somebody else will take the opposite point of view. And, you know, if that were not allowed, then
sure.
I think that we would start to disintegrate.
Sure.
So I don't think the answer is as important as the fact that we continue to ask it, and I'm glad that we continue to ask it. I'm glad that we had a controversy. I'm glad that some people, you know, still felt passionate enough to just sit on their hands, and others were passionate enough to stand up and cheer. And and the others of us, you know, were completely torn and twisted because our ideas went one way and our feelings are different. So,
sure. Jeff,
there you go.
Not to butt in here for a second, but I wanted to say one thing, and that is that you know, whatever you believe about Kazan and what he did between the House of Un-American Activities, he has become the touchstone for Hollywood about this. You know, the producers that were in Hollywood at the time easily gave up a lot of people. The problem was that Kazan wrote and directed and developed this persona of helping the small people, yet he gave them up. And I think that's the real question.
Well, but Victor,
let's hear from Victor on that.
Well, I think there are three separate issues from the questioner. One is, can you separate a man's art from his politics? And to me, yeah, if you are going to say who made great movies and who didn't, it's very easy to say that he made great films, just like you can say Leni Riefenstahl made some great movies.
Sure.
Then if you want to say, okay, but you want to evaluate his character, that's a different question. And when you give a Lifetime Achievement Award, does it have only to do with art, or does it have to do with contribution to the industry? So if it has to do with contribution to the industry, and part of his contribution was to make it harder for some people to work because of their politics, then that may become part of the calculus about whether he ought to get the Lifetime Achievement Award unless it's directed directly to art. I personally don't think it's possible to pass judgment on his character. I think it is possible to say, did he do the right or the wrong thing based on everything we know and what we would like to think we would do under the circumstances? And I don't think he comes off very well on that test. Then the final point that your caller raises is the one about what does it have to do with what's happening today with the terrorists and all that. And I think that's an important point. What it has to do with it is in times of trouble, when there is political hysteria, and it happened after World War I with the Palmer raids, and it happened with the McCarthy period that we're talking about, and it happened after September 11th, there is this tendency to want to give up constitutional freedoms and liberties in exchange for national security. Right. And there is a real national security. There are real national security problems. It always seems like this time it's different. And yet when history looks back at it, it always begins to look like the counter-subversives did more damage than the alleged subversives were ever going to do. And people say, well, but this time it's different. The World Trade Center blew up 3,000 people. Yep. Well, in the 50s, they said, when they sentenced the Rosenbergs to death, one of whom well may have been some kind of low-level spy, when they sentenced them to death, the judge said they were responsible for the death of 50,000 Americans, the Korean War. So you always...
The stakes are always high.
Yes.
Yes. Let's go back to Martin Scorsese mentioned poetic realism. Let's go back to that here with a scene from East of Eden. Set it up for us.
East of Eden, again, John Steinbeck's novel about a family that's being torn apart, two sons, a father, a missing mother. I think that what we're dealing with in this film is all about abandonment. James Dean plays a young man whose father is very distant from him, doesn't like him. His mother is not around, so he's always trying to get love from someplace. And in the scene that we're going to listen to, James Dean has worked very hard to raise the money, to make the money that his father lost in a business venture. Now, what's really interesting about this is the backstory about the acting. We talked a little bit about how did Kazan elicit some of these great things, these great performances. Raymond Massey plays the father. He is an old school, knows his cues, knows his marks, knows his lines. James Dean, new school, ad-libbing, emotional, trying to do everything that he can to get the best performance. In this scene, what happens is that Kazan knows that there's tension between the two of them because they're so different in their approaching to acting. And he actually uses the tension to get the responses of shock and genuine shock out of Massey and also to get the kind of emotional response out of Dean. Let's take a listen.
I don't want the money, Cal. I couldn't take it. I thank you for the thought, but
I'll keep it for you. I'll wrap it up and we'll discute it in here.
I'll never take it. Son, I'd be happy if you'd give me something like your brother's given me, something honest and human and good. Don't be angry, son. If you want to give me a present, give me a good life. That's something I could value. Cal!
James Dean and Raymond Massey.
He's crying there at the end because his father's rejecting yet another thing from him, and his father is completely befuddled. It's really just a wonderful, powerful scene.
And he's draped around.
And he's trying to give him the money and stuff it into his pockets.
Yeah, Jeff Young.
He's got his arms wrapped around his father's neck, and Massey is saying he would rather do anything than have this kid even touch him. He can't stand it.
And yet,
all the boy wants is his father to say, "I love you." That's all he wants. The most important thing in his world.
And of course, at the end, they do have when the father is stricken and actually speechless, they do have a kind of reconciliation, quite moving indeed. You know what strikes me about this film? I may be wrong, but this was, of course, in color, and it's the first film of his I remember seeing in color. And he made color, which in the era was just so florid and literal. He gave it a poetic feel. He gave it the feeling of black and white, to me at least.
Well that's correct. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting because obviously the East of Eden is the Cain and Abel myth, and Polanski told me, hey, Polanski, that whenever he would go to France, because he made this movie Force of Evil, which also dealt with the Cain and Abel myth, whenever he would go to France, they would say, what do you think of Kazan? And Polanski, of course, refused to name names. So he would say, why are you asking me about Kazan? I think he did a bad thing, but that's his business. It's not my business. He's not Hitler, so I'm not consumed with him. And he's not Christ, so he's not worth crucifying. But then some other critic wrote a thing where he said that each of them used their film to justify what they had done before the committee. And he argued that in East of Eden, Kazan had these poetically ambiguous characters and showed the ambiguity of the situation, whereas Polanski, in Force of Evil, showed that it was black and white, capitalism corrupts, and you have the good guy and the bad guy.
Mm-hmm. Darren Daley, we're going to end with a clip from Streetcar Named Desire, 1951.
You know, no matter what we say about Kazan, Streetcar Named Desire is an incredibly powerful film. You know, he takes Brando as a force of nature and makes him a force in this movie. And in the near the end of the movie, between him, Brando, and Vivian Leigh, there is a great piece of acting, wonderfully shot, incredibly directed, and it says everything we need to know about Kazan, the director.
As a matter of fact, my wire...
As a matter of fact, there wasn't no wire at all. There isn't no millionaire. I missed him coming here with roses because I know where he is. And there isn't a thing but imagination and lies and deceit and tricks. And look at yourself. Take a look at yourself here in a worn-out Mardi Gras outfit. Running for 50 cents of some rag pig with a crazy crown on. What kind of a queen do you think you are? You know that I've been on to you from the start, and not once did you pull the wool over this boy's eyes. You come in here and you sprinkle a place with powder and you spray perfume and you stick a paper lantern over the light bulb and lo and behold, the place is turning to Egypt and you are the queen of the Nile sitting on your throne sweating down my liquor. And you know what I say? Ha-ha!
Marlon Brando and Vivian Leigh and Streetcar Named Desire. Raw emotion, Jeff Young.
Well, that's correct. There's a great deal of raw emotion, but what Kazan did brilliantly is follow the emotion as it was laid out by the playwright, by Tennessee Williams. And the central character of the play is Blanche. And as Kazan wrote in his own notebooks, Blanche comes to Stanley and her sister Stella trying to find a safe harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And Brando, the Brando-Stanley character, is both attractive as well as he is repellent to Blanche. And she, like Tennessee Williams, he said, Tennessee Williams is Blanche. He is attracted to the very things that will destroy him, as was Tennessee. And that's the ambivalence of the entire play.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what made Kazan's version of that material so incredibly passionate and vibrant, is that he refused to allow Stanley Kowalski to just be a symbol of destructive,
yes,
destructive evilness. He was a full-rounded man.
Jeff Young, thank you very much. Jeff Young, dean of the Los Angeles Film School. Victor Navasky, thank you very much. Victor Navasky, author of Naming Names, and Garen Daley, thanks for joining us and
my
making
pleasure.
This night live for us. You can join the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.